Welcome to the Wellbeing Rebellion, the podcast that's changing workplace cultures for good. We're your hosts, Ngazi Weller
and Obehi Alafoje.
Let's get this rebellion started. Kate Headley is the co-founder and director of The Clear Company. She has been instrumental in leading a proactive, practical approach to disability inclusion throughout her career. Her ability to reach and influence senior decision makers and stakeholders across government and business has created lasting impact and change. Having experienced significant sight loss during the last 5 years, she has effectively demonstrated the positive impact of workplace adjustments in enabling her to maintain her level of professional influence and activity. Kate founded and continues to chair the UK's Recruitment Industry Disability Initiative, a national program to safeguard and progress opportunities for disabled job seekers by removing barriers in recruitment. RIDI has changed the lives of more than 500,000 disabled people since it started in 2011. Kate and I have known each other for many years now. In fact, I consider her to be a mentor and a friend. She has so much experience and expertise to share on the subject of disability, inclusion, and how this intersects with mental health and well-being. If you're a fellow well-being rebel who wants to see your workplace become more accessible for everyone, then this episode of the Wellbeing Rebellion is one surely not to be missed.
So, Kate, can you explain to our listeners what it is the Clear Company does and why, to you, it's so important?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the remit really of the Clear Company is to create inclusive workplaces and workspaces, although it's extending now to inclusive communities, inclusive supply chains, because, you know, we don't know when to stop, frankly. But the reason why it's important is because organisations, I think, complacently think sometimes that they are inclusive. There's a willingness there. There's a kindness, perhaps, within the culture, sometimes even a paternalistic culture, that thinks, therefore, it's getting it right. And what the Clear Company does is goes in and examines, well, are we getting it right? We run our Inclusion Maturity Index, which is obviously our platform to record how included everybody feels within an organisation. And we can use that, really, then to explain what is in reality going on. So I think the importance of the Clear Company is why I set it up 20 years ago. We're celebrating our 20th birthday this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Was because it's often the small things that make the biggest difference to people's work life experience. But those small things, if they're not known and there are barriers in the way, can create a huge problem for people feeling included at work and therefore being safe at work and flourishing at work. So, yeah, that's essentially what we do through audit, through learning, and through, obviously, we have our inclusion standard Clear Assured.
I mean, that just brings up so many interesting points for me, because when I was listening to you describe exactly what it is that you do, there's so many parallels between what you do at the Clear Company and what we do at Aurora. That whole idea of so many companies, especially the well-meaning ones, the ones who truly do care about their employees, feeling that just because they're nice people, that they're doing it well without having the expertise to point out that, well, this is where your blind spots are. These are the things that you need to change and improve. So that's one thing that I thought was really, really similar to one of the challenges we find in this space is companies who think they're doing mental health well because they're nice. And they say things like, your door is always open, so, you know. But where actually they need that expertise to say, you're not actually doing a deep dive look at what is preventing people from having issues. And then this whole thing about psychological safety and helping your employees to really feel content in the workplace, I think it's so important. How else can you thrive at work if you're not feeling like you are cared for, you are seen, you are understood, and you are valued? So that's so important. Thank you. And you're really busy. You wear a lot of different hats. I understand that you were recently appointed, let me get this right, Disability and Access Ambassador for the recruitment sector. When was that appointment made?
That was January 2022. after which I had COVID twice. So I officially really started in about May, June 2022.
Fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit more about that role? And also, you continue to chair RIDI. And I know we've talked about this a bit before, the UK's Recruitment Industry Disability Initiative. Yeah, so if you could tell us a little bit more about those two roles, that'd be great.
Yeah, I can do. And I can also say that, you know, thanks to my invaluable colleagues at the Clear Company, I'm being released from a lot of my operational work so that I can focus much more on disability inclusion, which is my, you know, as you know, one of my passions in life. And that's before I myself acquired a disability. So it goes back quite a long way. So the Disability and Access Ambassador really comes as a result of the work I've done with the Recruitment Industry Disability Initiative, which with a group of like-minded individuals, we decided that if we're going to close this employment gap for disabled people, if we're going to improve the experience of disabled job seekers through the industry and through the industry's employer clients, then we had to do something proactive. And the first thing we did was find out what was going on. To your point earlier, Ngozi, this is an industry that wants to do right. It's a people industry. You know, it's all about talent. So how is it going so horribly wrong in terms of the numbers? And that's, of course, where we know the numbers, and we don't know very many. This is not an industry that's lots of data. It's one of my challenges. So the first thing we did was some research to find out exactly what is the situation. So we researched the experience of recruiters and the experience of job seekers, and the mismatch was absolute. So job seekers are saying that they're, you know, less than 13% were being offered adjustments at any point in the recruitment process. And the recruiters are saying, you know, 98% of them are saying we offer adjustments at all time. So the warning bell then, to your point to employers, that's not because they're lying, by the way, and that has improved over time. We're about to release some new research, so watch this space. And when it looks at resources, the RIDI website will be one of those resources that has so much information on disability, including this new research. But the point is, people think they're offering adjustments if they're saying, you know, we can do a different time. I mean, that is quite a common adjustment, actually, but they don't understand the question that you're asked. And this is one of the challenges around procuring recruitment talent services as well. So you might say to your recruitment providers, are you inclusive? Are you disability confident? They're going to go, yes. And they genuinely mean it. They just don't actually know the depth of the question that you're asking, because that to me means everybody's had disability confidence training. Everybody can have an open dialogue around disability. Everybody's asked for adjustments at every single stage confidently of the process. So that's my mantra, is that we will create a disability confident industry, because obviously hidden disabilities is a particular challenge in recruitment context, because as my very dear friend Nick Goss, who's a wheelchair user, full-time wheelchair user, always says, you can see on their faces, thank goodness it's a real one, I know what to do with one of those, when he wheels into a reception area. But when I come with my white stick, or somebody else comes and they're nervous and shaking or can't go in the door or cancels at the last minute, they don't know what to do with that. So the both of those initiatives that I'm working, one is a cabinet office appointment, ministerial appointed disability ambassador. The other is a self-appointed role in terms of transforming the recruitment industry. It's all about educating, empowering and celebrating success. So just so that we're clear, I'm not an activist. I'm not standing on my soapbox. I don't tell people off. My self-appointed role is to encourage and embrace disability inclusion and make sure people do more of it. So that's essentially what we're doing.
And I guess that's why we get on so well, because there's one thing about
probably
there is a lot of pioneering work that has to be done, a lot of banging on the table saying this isn't good enough. But the fact is, both you and I, so both Aurora and the Clear Company, we're all about helping people make those changes and making it something that's attainable rather than out of reach. But you said something that was really interesting, and I'm not sure that all our listeners really understand what hidden disabilities are. I think I know, but it'd be good to know, what's your definition of a hidden disability then?
Well, anything non-visible, so mental health, sensory impairments, so hearing, vision, anything that isn't a visible disability. So if I don't walk in and present as I've got a walking stick, or I'm in a wheelchair, or I've got hearing aids that you can see that go, oh, I can tick that disability box, then it's a hidden disability. You've also got people with arthritis, fluctuating conditions such as myself. I have a condition called systemic lupus. You can't see that I've got that. You also can't see that I am severely partially sighted. I'm registered as such with the local council. Unless I've got my white stick, that's hidden from everybody. industry. So my kind of what I'm working on with employers and some brilliant ones, I mean, Virgin Atlantic has just come on board with Ridley. They were the overall winners last year for the inclusive attraction strategy, which transformed the numbers of disabled people working in that industry sector for them, which is amazing. But what we're working on is, let's stop putting a label on disability. Let's stop people having to say at any point in recruitment or at work, I have a disability, and therefore that accesses me to other processes and policies and structures within my organisation and within my recruitment process. What we're saying is, let's give every individual the opportunity to tell us if there's anything we need to know that impacts their ability to do their best, enjoy themselves, be safe and secure and flourish at work. So that could be anything to do with their life condition, you know, their life circumstances, disability and beyond. What happens when you do that, Ngozi, is that those people who don't either self-identify as disabled or have never felt safe sharing before start to share, because you're not saying to them, we need to know if you're disabled, because then you go into a process. What you're saying to them is, we want you to do so well at this. It's really important to us we see you at your best. Is there anything in our process, and this is what our process looks like, by the way, so you can have a look and then you'll know, that's going to cause you any sort of anxiety or is going to create any sort of barrier? And we ask every single person that same question, and they go in, and we obviously, again, as it's the Clear Company, we don't stop at the let's have three questions we ask ourselves. We invite everybody to go on a bit of a journey of discovery through our Clear Talents portal, and basically they learn things about themselves they didn't know. So we have a number of people, for example, who are asked questions around, you know, do you get stressed or anxious when you're approaching a new meeting? And they think, well, yes, I am, but nobody's ever asked me that before. So I'll click yes and see what happens. And then we give them a number of resources to help manage that anxiety and that stress. We give the managers, with their permission, the information that says this person might be a little bit more anxious. Give them 5 minutes at the beginning, make sure that the space and environments are all right for them. And it's just this fantastic voyage of discovery. And what I'd like to see longer term, and I'm sure I've said this to you before, is that we don't have organisations reporting on the number of disabled people in their organisations, because we're frankly never going to know, because people don't tell us and they don't put themselves in those boxes and so on. But we can report on the number of adjustments made, and we can report on the disability employment gap if we use that adjustment data and link that within our payroll and reward and remuneration. So I think there's a better way to establish our level of inclusion as well as our representation. And that's kind of what I'm doing in recruitment. And that's what I mean about the recruitment sector thinks it's getting it right, but it doesn't. And hidden disabilities, I think, is one of the biggest challenges. Neurodiversity, hidden disabilities, things that aren't relatable to the individual who's either recruiting or employing. So they think they know it because they've read a book or seen a podcast, you know, or heard a podcast. So they think they've got it. But actually, if you put a personality profiler at the front end of a recruitment process, or even a values profiler at the front end of a recruitment process, and ask somebody neurodiverse or somebody whose particular mental health condition or levels of anxiety or Asperger's means that they don't comfortably talk self ever, then my big question is around mental health and well-being generally is, I don't understand why we're having to ask those questions if it's nothing to do with doing the job. Because what it's doing is displacing an individual, causing additional stress and making them fail. So that to be fair, I probably do have a little bit of a soapbox about that one, because I just don't get it.
And there's nothing wrong with having one. There's nothing wrong with having a soapbox when you think something like this is so important. And I'll apologise to my listeners who weren't expecting me to get on a platform. But to be fair, if you know me, you know I'm going to get on a platform. I completely agree. As I don't know if I've told you this before, Kate, but a year ago I got diagnosed as ADHD. I know you know that I come from a neurodiverse family. I always thought it wasn't from my side of the family. I thought it was from my husband's side of the family, but it's me. And people who know me probably are not that surprised. I was. So I now understand from a personal perspective that it has made a difference throughout my career. I just didn't really know why. So when you talk about what you're really doing is making the whole process of working professionally in any industry any organization, any size, tailored to the individual, right? But accessible for the organization. So it's just about, instead of separating you out as you're the different one, and no, we care about your difference, we'll silo you into this one specific process, is about saying everybody is an individual. So whether you have a recognized, diagnosed condition or not, we want to make you as an individual thrive in our workplace so that we both can benefit from this. And who doesn't want that?
I mean, that's the point, and goes, and it's interesting you're saying about being diagnosed. So we'll have a separate conversation about that. You have told me that, but it's probably for a different podcast because you're interviewing me, which is obviously not a normal state for me. So I have to manage myself with enormous care. But I think, you know, organizations have to run, okay, and they have to be successful. So there are occasions, but we have to make, if we can make adjustments, then we should. And, you know, I always quote this lawyer at DWF LRP, give him a good shout out, for saying, you know, reasonable adjustments and adjustments should be limited only by your imagination. There's so much you can do. When you talk to an individual, I think, well, actually, if you just move that window a little bit there or that lighting there, you know, I had a client where we ran Clear Talents through, which is our reasonable adjustment or managed adjustments platform, where they had a whole floor in the building, come up with things that they couldn't see on the computer, a whole floor. Turns out the lighting was wrong across a whole floor. And you've got all of these people really struggling at work. So what I think where I'm coming from is that an organization does have to work. So if an adjustment can't be made, it's going to be rare, but then is it the right environment for the individual? And there are some environments that aren't right for all individuals. So there's a mature conversation to be had at that point. And I don't believe in really pushing an individual to the point at which their mental health may be impacted by the fact that actually they're in the wrong environment, despite the adjustments. So there's some mature conversations to be had around there. But I think generally speaking, what an organization needs to do is understand and know its people, and work based on fact. I was on a podcast last week for International Women's Day, and I was asked a question, you know, how do you create an inclusive and equitable environment for women? And my answer was very similar. Well, find out what that environment is like so far. So base it on fact, examine it, explore it, test it, get data. And one of the MDs on the same webinar actually said that his organisation had been pushing him really hard. The women were saying, you know, this is still a very male organisation, you know, you don't listen to us women. And that the male board were going, really, honestly, we're still having that old debate. And then they did the gender pay gap. And it showed them, in fact, on paper, that actually there was a distinct imbalance within their organisation. And that's when they took action. Now, I'm not saying it's right that they didn't listen. But what I'm saying is that it's the same with mental health, and it's the same with well-being, is that an organisation will rightly respond to data and fact and analysis, and not to, I don't think it's really right round here and I'm having a bit of a whinge. That's not going to get us anywhere. So we have to empower people to have a positive voice that can educate their organisation based on fact. That would be my thinking on that.
You are aligned with my thinking. I have said it so many times, especially when it comes to mental health and well-being. The people that we come across in HR are so well-meaning, and they believe that it's the right thing to do to support their staff. But I always say an organization's primary responsibility is to its shareholders. Without that, nobody has a job. So you must persuade with facts and not feelings. But the positive thing is the facts are on our side. The facts show that if you are an inclusive organization who makes reasonable adjustments, who makes the workplace accessible for the best and the brightest talent, you get the most rewards. So, yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah, of course you do. And they'll stay longer as well. You know, the number of people that leave and you know, particularly when we're talking about neurodiversity, and people that leave and the organisation will say, well, they never really fitted in, did they? I'm not surprised they've gone. And really what we should be doing at that point is examining ourselves as an organisation, thinking, what could we have done differently there? Because we obviously took them on as a talented individual. So what can we learn from that experience, really? That would be kind of one of my thoughts. I think the other thing is, Ngozi, as well, is that, you know, you've asked me the question before, you know, about periods of, you know, poor mental health or stress or anxiety that I've had to work through personally and others have to work through personally. And I often, I do quite a lot of work in boardrooms where I take, board away and actually look to engage them around, thinking differently about how people might feel. And I ask some difficult questions like, if there's anybody in the room who hasn't had that 3 o'clock in the morning panic attack at some point during their working life that made them almost incapable of driving to work, let alone doing anything positive when they were there, then you're a different person to me, because I've had that many times in my professional working life, and I'm sure lots of other people have as well. And it's not productive, because what then happens is it spirals into your personal life. You come back home at the end of that unproductive day, having achieved nothing other than being judged by your colleagues, to be stressed, anxious, and probably quite grumpy with your family. That creates, and it's just a ricochet effect. Whereas actually, if you worked in an organisation that trusted you so implicitly, that if you put the call in to your line manager and said, I've had a really shocking night's sleep, I've got myself into a right state, a couple of extra hours in bed and maybe a day working from home, I'm going to be all over that project for you. That's the environment we want to create. So we automatically trust people, whereas the historic working model, which is built on lots of politics and all sorts of things which I won't go into, but the historic working model would be, we don't trust our colleagues. They need to prove to us that they are where they say they are, that they have done what they say they're doing. And I think that creates tremendous strain, and it doesn't allow people with different thought processes, cognitive processing approaches. Some people work at, I work with a very, very, very senior guy who will be doing all his work between probably 11 at night and 5 in the morning, because that's how that's when he functions best. I don't function well in the evening. Once it gets to 8 o'clock, I can try really hard, but I might as well not be there because it's pointless. And I think that the truly healthy organisation allows those fluctuations to happen naturally with trust, well communicated, and the productivity will soar as a result. We've seen it in so many case studies. The biggest probably ever was BT.
So can you tell us a little bit more about what happened with BT?
It's a long time ago, but it still remains. And in fact, a very dear friend of mine at the time, who will be coming to my 60th birthday. So if you're listening, Caroline, wait for your invite. They took a punt at BT. They realised they got a lot of real estate and a lot of people working in offices that were really expensive. And this individual's Caroline Waters, OBE, her job at the time was to persuade the organisation that they should take a giant leap of faith, and that's exactly what she called it, and close all these offices and have people working remotely because they were so often empty. And I remember hearing her speak on it many times, and we became very close friends. It saved them. I can never remember whether it's billions or millions. I think it's billions. I think it's something like 2.1 billion in the first year, and then millions after that, in terms of the capital costs on the buildings, and productivity soared.
Incredible.
So that, where's the argument?
Mm. That's incredible. And for a lot of our listeners work in smaller organisations, much smaller than BT. When you look at how you can make the workplace more inclusive, more accessible for people, whether they have physical disabilities or mental health and well-being issues, and the ones who are wanting to do it right and recognising that they need to invest, it always seems like a very high bar. So when I listen to you talking, it seems like something that's so easy, the small shifts that you can do in thinking and in your practices and your approach to your employees in the workplace seems so accessible. But there are other things. When we present, we are focused on the upskilling and empowerment of your people as well, recognizing something that you said earlier about line managers being key. And that requires investment and commitment. And I think that's what seems to be a barrier for a lot of HR professionals struggling to get that kind of approval from the rest of the board for the spend and the investment. Do you have any advice on how they can do that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very firm on this because obviously I'm an HR professional by career. And I was trained at Marks & Spencer's, and at Marks & Spencer's, HR was an empowering and enabling function. That's what we were brought up to be. We were the visionaries supporting an organisation to grow and allowing the commercial colleagues to do their job well. And I do think that's how modern HR people should think. So at the risk of upsetting your listeners, I haven't got high tolerance for any audience that says, but they won't listen to me because I see our job then is to find how do we make people listen, because people don't not listen on purpose. It's because we've not interested them. We've not got their attention. We've not pushed the right buttons. So we need the credibility. We need to understand our business. We need to understand how that business operates, where the pain is for our executive board, where the push buttons are, what are their strategic goals, and how can we link what we're trying to do with those strategic goals. So if we go in and say, look, I think we should have a chat about mental health in the organisation, you're not necessarily going to get much traction. If you go in and say, look, you know, if we look at our sickness absence bill, our turnover rates, we've done some focus group case studies in terms of what might be impacting on people's productivity. This is the voice of the organisation. People who work here are actually saying these things about working here, which makes me feel very uncomfortable. I know it will make you feel very uncomfortable as well. Can we have a conversation about a plan I've got about how we could change that and actually make the organisation safer? You know, if we're talking about an insurance company with less risk, and as well as meeting our compliance objectives, be an exemplar within our sector, because this is what everybody's talking about right now. So wherever it is that your leader's buttons are pushed by, have that conversation, but have it at that level, not the, oh God, it's a blooming business. I get this as well, Ngozi, with recruiters. It's not us that don't recruit disabled people, it's our clients. And our client and the client companies go, it's not us that don't recruit disabled people, our recruiters don't get. I'm not interested in circular debates. Somebody has to pick up the gauntlet and take action. So if somebody's not listening to you, you have to put yourselves in their shoes and understand why and what would make them listening to you. Have you got your argument right? Or is it a personal argument that's actually not got its foundations, to your point, in what the shareholders' direction for that business is all about? So it's, I think, professionally mature HR professionals, of which there are many awesome examples, and I work with lots of them, I'm sure you do as well, they should be leading this debate, not asking for permission to have it.
Amen. That's exactly it. It is. I think the pandemic really was the first time the eyes of the entire workplace were directed towards HR. And they recognized, as I put it, they got invited up from the kids' table to the grown-ups' table in the boardroom. They've got this new position of power and responsibility. People are turning to them knowing that they're the ones who are central to sorting out furlough and other words we had no idea about until the pandemic. And they've kept that seat at the table, but some people aren't confident or aware of the power that they have. And it is, like you say, it's a role that's about driving the rest of the organization. And it's such a powerful role, and it shouldn't be one where you're waiting for permission to do what you need to do. It's about telling the organization, this is what you need in order to achieve the goals that you've set. So, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with what you said there.
I think self-education as well, Ngozi, is absolutely key. So, I mean, wellbeing is very topical at the moment. We've got a lot of the big organisations and smaller organisations who've got wellbeing champions or directors of wellbeing, you know, way beyond the role of the traditional occupational health director. So there's forums out there on LinkedIn, on, you know, Twitter, all of these kind of things. There's conferences about it. You know, I think what HR is very poor at, because of just space and capacity, is just assuming it can take on a new skill or a new area of expertise, because it should, because it's HR. Diversity inclusion is one of them. It didn't feature in my CIPD, and I'm sure it didn't, you know, feature in, well, I know it didn't feature in my contemporaries, but I'm considerably older than most of them. Until relatively recently, it didn't. So we have to self-educate to learn, not just assume that because we're HR, we will know about that as well. And I think wellbeing, mental health, and, you know, sort of a culture that's safe and psychological safety are things we have to learn about and understand and have a really good debate about that's evidenced by what other organisations are doing.
Love it. So, which leads me neatly onto my next point, which was, are there any resources that you'd recommend to our audience to help with becoming a more inclusive, a more differently able, inclusive company?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the context of the conversation, which was around sort of mental well-being, there's some very obvious ones like Mindful Employer and Mind and, you know, Time to Talk and all of these other things that you can bring in as resources into your organisation. I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But, you know, we didn't spend 20 years at the Clear Company twiddling our thumbs. So if anybody goes to the Clear Company website, we have significant free resources deliberately. So that there is a neurodiversity toolkit, there's a disability confidence toolkit, all of those kind of things. I think the other thing, particularly around disability, is, which is obviously my sort of mantra, if you like, is there's something about staying local as well. So, you know, working with local charities. So, you know, somebody I work with works very closely with WizKids in London, and they give a great deal of insight. You know, other people work, you know, with Positive About Autism, and, you know, they've got great tools and resources that I think lived experience. I'm bringing lived experience as opposed to making assumptions on behalf of people whose experience you haven't lived. It is really key. And obviously, there's the Disability Confidence Scheme, which is free, which is the government's one, which is currently under review. We're working on that quite closely. I was one of the original authors of that, as you know. And within my Disability Ambassadors role, I'm working with a group of employers and organisations to look at how we can develop a Disability Confident Free programme for micro businesses. So there'll be all of those kind of resources as well. But if you want to step it up again, you know, the things that we do at the Clear Company specifically, which we've developed specifically because they weren't there, are the Inclusion Maturity Index, which is a digital platform which can give phenomenal insights. It's global, and it can do it for smaller businesses, larger businesses, give those insights to start your journey. And then we've got our Clear Assured Inclusion Standard, which provides all of those resources. And of course, you know, for me, one of my biggest successes, and this was on the back of a piece of note paper with some like-minded people about 10 years ago, we felt that there was a real gap around providing adjustments. And so we've invested significantly in a managed adjustment platform. And if you take Lloyds of London, who hadn't had a single request for an adjustment at any point, they now manage hundreds of adjustment requests through their selection process and at work, every month, easily. And those people, those individual lives are changed, they're transformed. And so there's big resources out there, there's loads of free resources out there. And the obvious one, I'm going to say it, aren't I, is, you know, yourselves and Gozi at Aurora.
Thank you.
The work that you do and the feedback that you Aurora, listeners, Aurora did a session for Already Pioneers. So Already Pioneers are organisations who have opted to pioneer change through the recruitment industry, and their inaugural lunch, Ngozi generously gave a fair time for, and the feedback was absolutely fantastic. They felt really empowered and motivated and confident. So I wouldn't hesitate to do that either if I was one of your listeners.
Fantastic. Thank you. It's almost like a paging.
Well, you didn't.
I didn't.
I can assure you of that.
Yeah. Okay. One last question. And this is my signature question, because Kate's our first interview, but hopefully will not be our last. And hopefully you'll come back on again. But I'm going to ask this to as many people as I can that we come across in the Wellbeing Rebellion. And it's this. As a fellow wellbeing rebel, what's the one change that you'd like to see implemented in the workplace in terms of wellbeing?
So the one change for me would be, I think, as I say, is to move from people having to identify as being disabled or having a disability and actually being given open opportunity to talk about the impact of their workplace on their ability to perform well, be happy and thrive. And for that to be an all-inclusive approach, which is true inclusion. That would be my view.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. A pleasure to talk to you, and I've learned a lot, and I know our listeners will have benefited from all the wisdom that you shared with us. We will be sure to include as many links. You did give a lot of resources. We'll include as many links to those in the show notes as possible. And yes, we hope to speak with you again. Thank you very much, Kate.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wellbeing Rebellion.
If you liked what you just heard, please share it with your colleagues, follow us on LinkedIn, the link will be in the show notes, and generally show us some love.
We want to build a whole army of fellow rebels who want to create positive workplaces for everyone. Will you join the rebellion? See you next time.